Behind the Arc. A look around the country in college basketball. Behind the Arc. Hear about the week's biggest storylines, from blue bloods to mid-majors. Go in depth on the week's biggest matchups, bracketology, and which small conference schools should be on your radar. Behind the Arc. Here's your host, Joel Silverberg.
Welcome into Behind the Arc. I'm Joel Silverberg. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to the Behind the Arc podcast, whether it's on Apple Podcasts, Google, or on our website, 991thesportsanimal.com, or on the Sports Animal app. Really appreciate you taking some time to check out Behind the Arc. Again, I'm at Joel Silverberg on Twitter. You can follow me there. You can ask a question for the Behind the Arc podcast. And we're getting closer to basketball season. College basketball season starts next month. Practice started this week. So Tennessee is on the practice floor over at Pratt Pavilion, and the Vols are getting ready. We don't know the schedule quite yet. We don't know what it's going to look like. We know a couple of Tennessee's opponents. We know that Tennessee is supposed to play in the Charleston Classic. We know they're supposed to play in the Jimmy V Classic against Gonzaga. The SEC schedule is supposed to start in late December. They're going to participate in the SEC Big 12 Challenge. So we have an idea of what Tennessee's schedule could potentially look like. We don't have the full picture quite yet, but we are less than 2 months away from the college basketball season. It is hard to believe that this long wait feels like it's going to be over very soon, and hopefully it will be, and we'll be able to have a college basketball season that we don't miss the NCAA tournament for a second consecutive year. But for the big news in the NCAA this week has been the Division I Council electing to give winter student athletes a year of eligibility back. And I think this will have more of an impact in other sports than it will in basketball, especially towards the top of the game when you consider players that so often are one and dones or go after two or three seasons in college. In basketball, you just see so many athletes decide to forego their amateur status before their 4 years of eligibility is up anyway. And so I don't know how much of an impact this will make towards the top of the game, but I do think athletes being able to get that year of eligibility back, of course, this was a big dispute after what happened this past season with players getting to play an entire season, then not getting to have a tournament. There was some controversy over that. Well, the NCAA should give them back a season as well, because they did it for spring sport athletes who got to start their season but didn't get very far into it. So, for example, Tennessee's baseball team was given the opportunity to have a year of eligibility back for some of the players that lost a year. The basketball team was not. And I did not think that it should have. I did not think that Jordan Bowden, Lamonte Turner, guys like that. I know there were some fans calling, well, Jordan Bowden should be allowed to have another year of eligibility. He essentially played the entire season and didn't get to play in the SEC tournament. That really would have likely been Tennessee's year, and then maybe an NIT berth. That would have been about it. But it's unfortunate that we didn't get to see the NCAA tournament, and how exciting it would have been with Gonzaga. Could they have finally broken through? Dayton with Obi Toppin, would they have spoiled the party and made a run to the Final Four? Just so many good teams in the field last year. Obviously very disappointing that we didn't get that this past season. But I do not think that players should have been given an extra year of eligibility, because you did play the whole season, the whole regular season anyway. It's unfortunate that we didn't get a postseason, but to say that the players didn't get a whole year, it just isn't true. And for this season, seeing what the NCAA is doing with college football, that this year essentially doesn't count. Now, winter sport athletes are going to have the same opportunity. I don't know what that's going to mean for men's college basketball. I do think it'll help the mid-majors. I think those are the schools that it helps the most, with players that have seasoned veterans that maybe aren't going to be incredibly high draft picks in the NBA draft or draft picks at all. So from this past season, you see schools like Belmont, which are loaded but didn't necessarily have an NBA caliber player, you know, a high pick on its team. I wouldn't say that it would have helped a team like Dayton, because I think Obi Toppin, obviously being a projected top 10 pick, he's gone regardless. Does it save guys from going to the transfer portal and trying to take a step up? Maybe, but I think it also helps the transfer portal. It's going to make the transfer portal a little bit more fluid, because you're going to have players from mid-major schools deciding, well, I had this season to see what I can do. I feel really good about the odds of me going to a power conference school. I'm going to transfer and see if I can technically move up a level. And so I think you'll have a lot of players continue to do that, and a number of players do that already. But I don't see a team like Kentucky with all these one and dones that they have on a regular basis and having this recruiting class that it's having now. I don't think that's going to change some of these players from deciding, yeah, I'm going to come back to going to Kentucky, or I'm going to go ahead and go to the NBA draft. I think it's really going to be a matter of, it's going to help schools that rely on a lot of depth and veteran leadership and upperclassmen that are good college basketball players. And I don't know how much of an impact it'll really have towards the top of the league. And I don't know how much of a shift that's going to really create in terms of competitive balance towards the top of the country. And I think the best players in the country are going to go ahead and go to the NBA. And I think players that are solid are either going to transfer to bigger schools or they're going to stay at their mid-major team. So I think it helps depth for some of the top teams. If anything, it's going to feed those schools more. But I do think it can help the mid-majors if you have a number of guys that you can have the opportunity to develop and get more talent and get more seasoned leadership for some of your upperclassmen. So if you have a freshman or sophomore that's a really solid player in regards to the Atlantic Sun Conference or the Big South, if you're at a school like UNC Greensboro, okay, maybe there is a way that you can take that step forward and retain all the talent that you have. Because really what I think it's going to do, the biggest shift that I think you're going to see is within the transfer portal. I think you're going to see guys from mid-major schools and smaller power conference schools decide, I'm a pretty good basketball player, I've got a year of eligibility left, I'm, you know, probably won't have to sit out for a year, and if I do, I still have that eligibility at whatever school I go to, I'm going to take the chance and I'm going to go somewhere else. So it may not work out the way that the NCAA is hoping, but I do think the NCAA is doing the right thing with so much uncertainty, is allowing student athletes to have the opportunity to continue being able to play when there may not be what they signed up for this season when they committed to play college basketball at the school they're choosing. Gino Auriemma, the UConn women's basketball coach, he believes that a lot of coaches are going to object to this because you may be planning on players leaving and then suddenly a player decides they want to come back to school and you may not have room for them because of your recruiting class. And so what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to send the player out? So it will be interesting to see how the NCAA handles this in terms of the individual schools, because we originally heard when it came to spring sports that the NCAA was leaving it up to the school to determine whether or not it was going to offer its student athletes an extra year of eligibility. Wisconsin was the first major school to say, hey, no, we're not going to allow you to come back. So for its, you know, its baseball, its tennis, its track teams, they were essentially saying, look, we appreciate everything that you've done for us, but if you are out of eligibility, we're going to have to ask you to not come back because we're trying to cycle in new recruiting classes. And that may be different now that we're thick into the pandemic and it's not something that's still new and we're trying to figure out. There have been some protocols set in place and I feel like college athletic departments should have a better grasp on how to handle the whole situation. So you may see less of that, and we'll see what the NCAA ultimately decides to do in terms of its methods with how it wants to enforce all of this. But big news for winter sport athletes and for college basketball players that they're, if they want, they can keep that year of eligibility before going overseas or going to the NBA. And I think obviously the majority of players are not going to play in the NBA. The majority of players are not going to get drafted. So there are a lot of players that are going to benefit from this, but I do think you're going to see a lot of transfers. I think you're going to see mid-major teams hurt by it, where you're going to see less depth in a season where this past year, conferences like the Big South at one point had three teams potentially that could have all vied for a spot in the NCAA tournament. ETSU, of course, ended up winning the championship there, but Furman and UNC Greensboro were teams that could have been competitive and could have had a shot at it. At one point, it was looking like a two-bid league. The Atlantic 10 Conference at one point was looking like a three-bid league and then turned into a one-bid league over the last 2 weeks of the season. But the point being is those schools all thrive on solid players and upperclassmen that have developed really well in college. And when you start losing those players to the rest of the country, well, that gets frustrating for those programs to have to maintain high standard of play. Tennessee's benefited from that with EJ Anasicki being an upperclassman and a graduate transfer and deciding that he didn't want to play at Sacred Heart anymore. Now, Anasicki is going the traditional route of a grad transfer. He's fulfilled his undergraduate degree. He got his education, has a degree from Sacred Heart, said, hey, I've got 1 year of eligibility left. I'm going to go to Tennessee or my sister went. And so that one makes more sense. That's a little bit more of an ideal fit. But from Sacred Heart's perspective, again, that was not a team that was coasting through the NEC in the Northeast Conference. That was a team that, you know, was having to kind of stay behind teams like Robert Morris and the other schools that are in that conference that were actually competing for the conference championship. And so now for a school like Sacred Heart, it loses its best player, and now it's got to continue to get good players and keep those good players from transferring to other schools now that they have their eligibility back. So all in all, I think it's a good solution for the NCAA. I think they're doing the right thing. Let players have the opportunity to transfer, especially with so much uncertainty around the college basketball season. They're getting to play fewer games this year. But be wary that some of these mid-major schools with good talent could be losing those players next year if coaches are unable to retain them, if they're unable to recruit at a high level and give some of these better players on their roster a reason to stick around at that mid-major school for another year. Joe Lunardi released an updated bracketology last week for the first time in a while, and he's got Tennessee up there. What does he say about the Vols and the first round matchup that he's projecting? It's going to make Tennessee fans roll your eyes. I'm Joel Silverberg. It's the Behind the Arc podcast on the Sports Animal. I appreciate you checking out the Behind the Arc podcast. Again, I'm at Joel Silverberg on Twitter if you have a question or comment for the show. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, be sure to hit that subscribe button, leave a 5-star rating with a review, and feel free to ask a question in your review as well. We'll make sure to get to it on the next edition of the Behind the Arc podcast. Joe Lunardi had not released a bracketology update in about 2 months. He took September off, and now with the season coming up next month, he's got his early projection for now of what he thinks could happen for the 2020-2021 college basketball season. Now, he's had Tennessee as a 5 seed for most of the fall and late summer, and he still has Tennessee as a 5 seed. Kentucky is a 4 seed, the highest ranked SEC team. He's got 7 teams from the Southeastern Conference in his bracket. He's got Kentucky as a 4, Tennessee is a 5, Florida is a 6, Alabama is a 10, LSU is an 8, he has Arkansas as a 10, he has 7 teams total in his bracket. So you're seeing, obviously, a lot of depth within the SEC, much like what it looked like what we could have had last year, and then things kind of fizzled out towards the end of the season for the SEC. But what I'm noticing here is there's not really that one high seed. And that's something that sticks out to me, because Kentucky's going to have the expectations to be better than a 4 seed. Tennessee being widely projected as a top 12 team, and in several publications, a top 10 team. You heard Chris Dortch on this podcast last month talking about how he believes that Tennessee is a top 5 team. And John Rothstein of CBS believes that Tennessee is the best team in the SEC. Well, it would put Tennessee higher than a 5 seed, right? Especially with the non-conference schedule that Rick Barnes is trying to build. You have that matchup against Gonzaga coming up, the Charleston Classic. We'll see who all ends up participating in that. The SEC Big 12 Challenge. What if Tennessee gets Baylor in that and ends up getting to play the Bears? I mean, that would really boost Tennessee's resume. So I would think that a 5 seed, I would feel like that's the floor for Tennessee. And honestly, you could make an argument that a 4 seed is the floor for Tennessee this year, because the expectation is that Tennessee could play its way into being an Elite Eight or Final Four contender. Well, to me, that's not a 4 seed. That's at least a 2 or a 3 seed. So I think for Tennessee right now, the projection has been a little bit low. And for Kentucky, I feel like a 4 seed is low as well. When you consider the talent that John Calipari has coming in, and how it's supposed to be this neck and neck 2-horse race between Tennessee and Kentucky, the best recruiting class in the country for the class of 2020, hands down, is going to Lexington. So I'm a little surprised to see both of those seedings so low. And I realize that there's high expectations in the Big Ten, in the ACC, the Big 12, with having a team, with having two teams like Kansas and Baylor, having two behemoths instead of just the usual one, as it has a little bit lately, and you consider what all of these other conferences are going to bring to the table. And so I get it. You know, the Big Ten, you have the usual suspects, Michigan, Michigan State, Ohio State's going to be really good. But now all the attention this year is around Iowa and Illinois, because Iowa getting Luka Garza coming back, Illinois getting Io DeSunmu and Kofi Coburn both coming back to Underwood's team. So the expectation is that there's going to be more depth. But will those teams start to cannibalize each other? Keep in mind, the Big Ten had a three-way tie at the top of its standings with three teams going 13-5. So these teams are taking a handful of losses. And whichever team wins that conference is going to get a bigger bump in terms of NCAA tournament seedings. But do the overall resumes really max out to, you know, two or three teams from the same conference all getting three seeds or higher? I don't think it does. I don't think it should. Now, with the lack of an in-depth non-conference schedule, those teams may not take their lumps. But if Gonzaga is going to be a number one seed, and Villanova out of the Big East, if they're going to be a number one seed, and then you look at some of the other Big East teams, you're going to like Creighton. Seton Hall, I feel like, is going to take a step back. Miles Powell was just so good for them and did so much for them last year. And credit to Kevin Willard, because he got some key wins with Miles Powell not in the lineup, including against a top 10 Maryland team. And Maryland's another team in the Big East that should be expected to do some really good things. They lost some talent, but that team's not going to go away and simply be walked over by every other team in the Big Ten. I forgot to mention Ole Miss out of the SEC teams that Lenardi has in the NCAA tournament. He's got them as an 11 seed playing in against Seton Hall, which is also an 11 seed. And he's got two Atlantic 10 teams, two West Coast Conference teams, and two American teams. So in terms of the multi-bid leagues, he's got a couple of other mid-major teams sneaking in there outside of the usual Power Six. So for Lenardi, Tennessee is a five, Kentucky is a four, everybody else in the SEC is looking up at the Wildcats and the Volunteers. And he has Tennessee going to Providence in the Midwest region as the five seed against Loyola Chicago. He's got Tennessee going up against Sister Jean and Loyola Chicago again. If you remember, a couple years ago, Tennessee surprised everybody after being picked to finish 13th in the SEC, ended up being co-champions in the regular season, lost in the SEC tournament final to Kentucky, was a three seed in the NCAA tournament, skated by Wright State pretty easily in the first round, lost to Loyola Chicago in the second round. Loyola Chicago beat Miami, beat Tennessee, beat Nevada, I believe, and then beat Kansas State to make the Final Four before losing to Michigan in what was the big Cinderella run of that tournament a couple years ago. So Joe Lenardi having a little bit of fun with Tennessee suffering an upset. And he's kind of trolled Tennessee a couple times now, because he's putting Tennessee in with Loyola Chicago in this bracket. He had Tennessee and Georgia State in an earlier projection in a first-round matchup, and I realize that's a football matchup, but still, I think Tennessee fans have heard enough about Georgia State for the foreseeable future when it comes to the Vols being upset by smaller schools in football and men's basketball. We'll get a recruiting update on the other side when we come back and wrap up today's edition of the Behind the Arc podcast. Recruiting notes in the SEC, recruiting notes involving Tennessee basketball. Again, the season just a month away, but already recruiting news, big recruiting news coming up from around the country for the class of 2021. It's the Behind the Arc podcast on the Sports Animal. Tennessee was in high on Jabari Smith, one of the top recruits in the country for the class of 2021. The Vols were really high on him, as well as Paolo Banchero, who committed to Duke earlier this offseason. That was somebody that Tennessee was really hoping to be able to utilize in conjunction with Kennedy Chandler, who has already committed to Tennessee. Last week, Smith announced that he was going to Auburn. So the 6'10 power forward out of Tyrone, Georgia, has announced that he is going to join Bruce Pearl's team. That's not really something you want to see if you're Tennessee. The Vols were really high on both Smith and Banchero, who are both two top five recruits, two five-star guys that are both big men, both big forwards. Banchero at 6'9", Smith at 6'10", and Tennessee so far has missed out on both those guys. Now, again, those are just commitments, so until pen meets paper, schools are going to continue to recruit players until they've signed that letter of intent. But Tennessee missing out on trying to officially make a two-headed monster within the class of 2021. Right now, Kennedy Chandler remains the only five-star commitment for Tennessee in the class of 2021. And again, just one of two commitments in the class of 2021 back in September. Jamai Meshack committed to Tennessee as well, the 6'5 small forward out of California. So Tennessee still with two commitments, five-star point guard, the number one point guard in the class of 2021, Kennedy Chandler, who's going to play his senior season at Sunrise Christian Academy in Wichita, Kansas, but again, is originally from Memphis, and the Vols won him over Memphis, as well as North Carolina and Duke. So a really good look for Tennessee, and then Jamai Meshack committing to Tennessee last month. But that is what we're looking at right now for Tennessee's class of 2021. And the Vols are going to continue to recruit. They're going to be in on targets, and there's still a lot of top players within the top 100 of the class of 2021 who are still undecided, and Tennessee is going to continue to hit the recruiting trail. Looking around the rest of the SEC, and we'll move to the rest of the country here momentarily, but earlier this month, Alabama got a really nice commitment from JD Davison, a five-star point guard out of Alabama who chose the Tide over Auburn. That's a really big win for Nate Oates. A really impressive commitment there. Second commitment already for the Tide this season. They already have one from four-star small forward Jaswan Holt, who committed to them back in September. So Alabama gets two commitments a week apart, a four-star and a five-star, and Nate Oates really starting to put together an impressive recruiting class for the class of 2021. So JD Davison, a player who's considered number one in the state of Alabama, top 10 nationally, kind of going back and forth with Kennedy Chandler as the top two point guards in the class of 2021. And they're both coming to the SEC, and Davison choosing Alabama over Auburn. Jabari Smith, we just mentioned, choosing Auburn over Tennessee and Alabama. It goes to show the impressive coaching that I think has been added to the SEC over the last several years. You've got a lot of coaches that have NCAA tournament experience. You have new coaches that have had success at smaller schools that are already showing they can be pretty competitive. Nate Oates at Alabama, Eric Musselman at Arkansas, Kermit Davis at Ole Miss has already taken the Rebels to the NCAA tournament once in his tenure. The list goes on and on. I think it is really interesting to see how competitive this conference can be, and there's a reason why Joe Lenardi has seven SEC teams going to the NCAA tournament. Around the rest of the country, Ryan Mutombo, the son of NBA Hall of Famer Dikembe Mutombo, chose Georgetown. He is going to go there. And again, a four-star recruit outside the top 50, but still a really big get for the Hoyas, and going to where his dad was an All-American and a two-time Big East Defensive Player of the Year. Tennessee was really in the mix with Georgetown to potentially land Mutombo. So that's why I bring that up, is because the Volunteers had a shot, and Mutombo kind of admitted Tennessee was in the mix. And so for the Hoyas to be able to hang on to that commitment over a school like Tennessee that's been really gaining some traction on the recruiting trail. Rick Barnes has done an excellent job at showing how well he can develop recruits, both the five-star guys, how he can bring them in, and getting the three-star guys to suddenly become NBA draft picks, as he's done multiple times already since arriving in Knoxville a few years ago. But Mutombo, again, following where his dad went to school, it was just going to be really hard to knock off the Hoyas in that recruiting battle. So a really big get for Patrick Ewing, for him coaching at Georgetown and getting Mutombo's son Ryan to head on over to Georgetown and play some basketball in the Big East. So the four-star commitment out of Atlanta, Georgia, heading out to where his dad played as he made his announcement earlier this month. A team that I feel like is making a lot of recruiting progress and doing it a lot very quickly, and it comes as no surprise, but after losing so much talent last year, Oregon has been on fire over the past month. A month ago today, back in September, Nathan Biddle got things started for the Ducks, the 6'11 center out of California, one of the top 20 recruits in the country. He's a five-star that joins Dana Altman's team. Then less than a month later, Jonathan Lawson, a small forward out of Memphis. So going into SEC country, pulling him out of there, getting him to go to Oregon, 6'6 small forward, a three-star recruit. And again, okay, three-star why should we be excited about it? That's a top 100. But it, again, that metric with that three-star, you see you have some three-stars that are ranked outside the top 200 in their class. Jonathan Lawson is the third-ranked player in the state of Tennessee and is a top 150 recruit in the country. That's a good three-star get for Oregon, going across the country and getting Lawson out of Memphis. And then 3 days after that, earlier this weekend, Frank Kepning out of Pennsylvania, a 6'11 center, four-star, ranked second in the state of Pennsylvania, top 10 center, top 30 recruit nationally, going all the way to Oregon. So Oregon, three commitments in the past month, one a five-star, and then a four-star and a three-star from across the country. And Dana Altman continues to thrive on the recruiting trail, which is big because it's kind of a reloading year for Oregon. You don't have Peyton Pritchard anymore dominating that backcourt for you. And again, that guy was a legitimate Wooden Award candidate. And obviously, Luca Garza and Obi Toppin took over that race down the stretch. But I don't know if there was a single player in the country last year that was more valuable to his team's success than Peyton Pritchard. And at times, that bit Dana Altman and the Ducks because they relied on him way too much. He was exhausted at the end of games. But Peyton Pritchard, one of the most, the heaviest workloads, I think, in the country for a backcourt player in college basketball last year. They are going to miss him. Really good to see Dana Altman continuing to have recruiting success because it's an opportunity to really do some damage out in the Pac-12. USC, of course, is going to be competitive. Stanford getting some recruiting momentum going. Of course, losing Tyrell Terry certainly hurts from last year. And then UCLA, Mick Cronin, I thought, did some really good things in his first year after a slow start. They almost won the regular season Pac-12 championship, and he's going to continue to do some good things over there out in Westwood. So that's a recruiting update around the rest of the country as well as the SEC and what Tennessee's been up to. So Tennessee, two recruits that have committed to Tennessee, five-star Kennedy Chandler, four-star Jamai Meshack out of California, and the Vols missing out on Jabari Smith, but still going to be on the recruiting trail. And Rick Barnes, I guarantee you, he's not going to be done with this class anytime soon. I appreciate you checking out the Behind the Arc podcast. Again, hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts. Leave a 5-star rating and review. And be sure to tell a college basketball fan you know about the Behind the Arc podcast. You can reach out to me at Joel Silverberg on Twitter. Be happy to answer any of your college basketball questions. And I appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. The college basketball season starts next month. We'll be talking about all of it throughout the course of the year right here on the Behind the Arc podcast.
Behind the Arc with Joel Silverberg on The Sports Animal.